Joquan Wayne Hawkins versus Commonwealth. Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is David Hargett.
And Mr. Hargett, I hate to interrupt you. Do you want to reserve a certain amount of your 15 minutes for rebuttal?
I would say 3 minutes, Your Honor.
All right.
Yes, thank you.
You may proceed when you're ready.
Yes. Again, my name is David Hargett. I represent Mr. Hawkins on his appeal of his convictions out of Charles City County. This is a fairly narrow issue here, but it is a case of first impression as far as the Attorney General's offices are concerned. There aren't any cases out there that directly decide this particular issue. And it has to do with the aggravated malicious wounding statute, which, of course, requires the intent to commit malicious wounding, and so the only thing that makes it aggravated is the resulting injury. The way the statute is phrased is that the act causes one to suffer, so it causes the victim, if you will, in this case, to suffer significant permanent physical impairment.
And that's how the jury was instructed.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Yes, sir.
So there's no dispute about how they were instructed, and there's no dispute about whether a scar, especially a lengthy and thick scar, could qualify as a significant permanent physical impairment. There's case law on that. The question is the causation. So in this particular situation, there is nothing else about his injury that would suggest that there is permanency or severity.
Excuse me, but did the jury, in light of the way they were instructed, find that causation as a fact?
I would say no.
Why?
I would say that
if they hadn't, they couldn't have found him guilty, could they?
Well, this is not a factual issue. This is a question of whether the motion to strike should have been granted as to the aggravated portion of the malicious wounding charge.
Well, after that, but the jury apparently found as a fact the fact of causation, did they not?
I would say that they certainly had to have agreed that it caused that injury, and that injury was permanent.
Well, is that a question of fact or law?
No, because here's a situation where this is like saying that if the sufficiency is not there, and you argue to the judge, but the judge disagrees and the jury finds him guilty, then you can't challenge that? Obviously, you can. If it's insufficient regardless of what the jury did.
Well, counsel, the General Assembly uses the word cause in the statute. Generally, when we talk about cause in the law, we're talking about proximate cause. Is there any reason to believe the General Assembly did not intend proximate cause when they used cause?
Well, they certainly could include proximate cause, but I think that there's some ambiguity there. I don't think that you can specifically say for certain the way the statute is written that causes doesn't specifically refer to the defendant causing the injury.
Well, you will agree that the defendant shooting the victim in this case was a proximate cause of the surgery and hence the scar.
I wouldn't concede to that, no. And the reason why is because I think that there is a superseding intervening action. Of course, the superseding part is the most important part. And so you have a situation where, and keep in mind, and there is some discussion here between the judge and the attorneys about whether medical evidence is necessary.
Well, taking the evidence in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth, are you taking the position that the shooting did not cause the surgery, did not necessitate it?
It did not directly cause it, there's no evidence that it necessitated it.
So being shot, placed in an ambulance, taken to a hospital emergency, and being operated on, the jury can't draw the conclusion that those two events are causally related?
They're causally related. I mean, keep in mind, this is like a hypothetical in law school. Causally related does not really answer the question. Of course, anything could be causally related. I could be late to court because lightning strikes a tree, 5 miles down the road, but that doesn't mean that that's the reason I'm late to court necessarily. So the causation is a much broader thing.
I think that'd be a very good excuse for being late to court.
Well, fortunately, the court started a little later today, so it was okay.
What does foreseeability circumscribe the extent of causation?
No, because the argument that the Attorney General's office has made is exactly that you're deemed responsible for the natural and probable consequences of your acts and those which are foreseeable. Mm-hmm. That has to do with intent. That only has to do with deciding whether or not there is sufficient intent. So when you're talking about foreseeability and it cites the police officer chasing an individual, yep, and the police officer has an accident and causes injury, is that a cause, a proximate cause?
Well, the argument in that case was that the chase by the police officer was broke the causational relationship. What did it here? What broke the causation relationship?
The surgery.
The surgery itself.
The surgery itself.
So, but if we find that the surgery, that the shooting was the act that in the natural and continuous sequence, unbroken by a superseding cause, caused the surgery and hence the scar, you lose, correct?
But you have, that's correct. But you have to make an assumption that the surgery was caused by the shooting.
Well, didn't the jury conclude that?
I don't. Again, it doesn't matter what the jury concluded. This is a sufficiency argument.
But don't we have a lot of case law that says that individuals are presumed to intend the natural and probable consequences of their actions? So if you shoot someone in the abdomen, isn't it, given all the organs that are in your abdomen that could be therefore injured, as well as the entry of the wound, the bullet itself, why can't it be then presumed that there was an understanding that the wound would be so grievous that surgery would be necessary?
It's the wrong analysis. That's why you can't do that. The natural and probable consequences of your acts has to do with an intent analysis. This is not an intent analysis. We're not disputing whether he had the intent to commit a malicious wounding. This only has to do with the aggravated portion of that charge, which is completely separate and apart from any analysis about whether he had the intent.
Is it your position that if the shooting had not occurred, the surgery would have occurred anyway?
I can't say anything about what would have happened if the shooting had not have happened.
Well, right, but it seems to me that makes the shooting the causative element in the decision to have surgery.
Well, I mean, that's an easy assumption to make, but it's not based on anything in the record. I would certainly agree. If we had a medical doctor here who testified that because of the entry wounds, he thought it was medically necessary to go in and do this, and actually did do some type of surgery other than opening him up and looking in him, then potentially we have a much different case. But we don't have that evidence here. We don't have anything from any medical testimony. And it's certainly true the medical testimony is not always necessary to establish the aggravated portion of the malicious wounding. But in this particular case, it might have been.
You say it's not always necessary. What makes it necessary or renders it unnecessary? How do you divide that?
Well, because there is case law that talks about this. If a person says, I can't walk correctly any longer, I can't get out of bed because of this injury. Those are sorts of things that the jury can conclude that, number one, that hasn't done better, so it's permanent. So they can make some permanency.
But you don't argue, do you, Mr. Hargett, that if the scar itself were caused by the wounding, the scar itself, that's not enough? Your question is, your argument is with who caused the scarring, the surgeon or your client. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So let me ask you about this court's decision in Newton from 1995, where the court said the trial court reasonably could have found from the number of wounds the need for stitches for some of them and the resulting scars still visible after 5 months that the victim's injuries constituted permanent and significant physical impairment. Why wouldn't that be very persuasive on the court today?
The scars in Newton were caused by the bullet, and the sewing up of the holes caused by the bullet.
But the sewing up, why isn't that the same thing as the surgeon sewing him up after the incision? Just bigger incision this time.
Because the incision wasn't caused by the bullet. It was caused by a knife wielded by the surgeon.
Which wouldn't have been necessary but for the shooting.
But in Newton, this scar, to some degree, is caused by the stitching that's put in, right? Sewing up. It's just a smaller sewing up.
I'm not sure how that's possible. Here is much different. The bullet holes were healing. There's no claim that the bullet holes themselves
left the scar.
Right. Okay? So what's the other option with regard to Newton? Newton really has to do with whether a scar in and of itself is a qualifying result to support aggravated malicious wounding. That's what Newton says, right? So if you look at it in the case of what caused the scar was caused in Newton by a bullet wound that had to be sewed up. I think that you can certainly say that they had to be sewed up. If it didn't, it certainly could have been infected. He could have died. And so much, you know, we wouldn't be talking about malicious wounding. We'd be talking about first or second degree murder.
In Newton. But here, why doesn't that also apply? That if he hadn't had the surgery, he might have died.
There's no evidence of that. There's absolutely no evidence of it. That's the problem here. There's no evidence from a medical doctor. There's no evidence from the victim himself as to why surgery was conducted.
Well, and so your position is a rational fact finder could not look at the evidence that he was shot, he was emergently taken to a hospital, losing consciousness on the way, and had surgery. The jury can't connect those dots. You think there's something missing?
I think that under the context of the way that this statute has been written, yes, there is something missing.
It's only an irrational fact finder could believe that the bullet caused the need for surgery.
It's not irrational. It's speculation and assumptions. Those are completely different. But you can't have speculation in a criminal case. You can't make assumptions in a criminal case.
How long was he in the hospital after this? It was a pretty good amount of time. We have testimony on that, right?
I don't recall the length of the hospital stay.
2 weeks, if I remember correctly. I think it was 2 weeks.
So is your argument that, given there was a two-week hospital stay?
We don't have any information as to why it was 2 weeks. Could have been so that the surgical scar could have healed, right? I mean, that's pretty much what it kind of boils down to.
Observing him essentially so that he doesn't have an infection from the surgical incision.
I don't know. I mean, here we're engaging in speculation is exactly what I say we can't be doing. Mm-hmm. And I see that I'm in the bubble.
Obviously, you have no duty to put on any defense, you know,
correct,
unless you want to. But what would preclude defense counsel from putting a doctor on saying he didn't need the surgery?
Nothing. Nothing would preclude a defense attorney from putting on a doctor to say that. And then we'd have a much different case. All right, I would like to reserve the remaining time.
Absolutely. I'll give you 3 minutes. Mr. Murphy?
Gene Murphy for the Commonwealth. Sort of getting into two different issues here. One is, can such a surgical intervention ever be the result of the original act? That is, I think, what the argument basically is, that if, in fact, there is ever an intervening event, the defendant is not culpable, liable for the result because it wasn't directly caused. And I think the defendant argued on brief that direct causation was required. That's not generally, as Judge Russell has pointed out, that proximate cause is generally what the court reads into it. And if you look at all of the homicide cases where this issue comes up fairly frequently, that issue is proximate cause. Was it a cause? And was it because it can be more than one probable proximate cause. And I've cited the Brown case, which is the case where the officer who is pursuing the defendant runs into somebody and kills a third party. And the court found the defendant responsible in that case because it was his action that set the whole chain of events in motion, and that there was nothing unforeseeable, there was no break in the chain. Similarly here, what you have is somebody who shoots the victim in the abdomen with a .45 caliber weapon. He has to go to the hospital, that's undisputed, and he, I think, has conceded that if, in fact, there was medical evidence, then our case would be established. And I think that is one issue. The second issue is if, in fact, evidence is presented, and he says it had to be presented here, and it generally becomes a jury issue. And as the court has already mentioned, the jury found that this event caused the surgery scar. So I think either way you look at it, the real question is, what did we have to show? We had to show only, I think, proximate cause, and I think that's clear. The claim that somehow we had to present testimony that surgery would have been necessary.
Medical testimony.
Yes, sure. You know, after, despite the fact that it was undisputed that he was shot in the abdomen by a high caliber weapon, and that he was in the hospital for 2 weeks.
Is there any evidence at all about any specific damage to a specific organ in the record?
No, Your Honor, none whatsoever. But I think that's the point. I mean, there's so many vital organs in that. That's what the
you
judge said.
You have testimony that he still feels pain in his abdomen.
Yes, sure. I mean, he still feels pain. It's not necessarily permanent or debilitating, but...
And no problems with digestion or bowel movements?
Not at this point,
sort of
right. Okay. No evidence of that whatsoever. But the point is that the judge himself, the trial judge, said, wait a minute, if you shoot somebody in the pelvis, there's going to be surgery. I think you can't just assume that a doctor will say, well, the bullet's out now, we're not going to worry about it. That it's just common sense that it's going to result and require an operation. Now, I mean, the Commonwealth could have gone to the bother of putting somebody on to prove that, but I think that the judge and the fact finder can certainly rely upon those inferences that, in fact, no reasonable doctor is going to say, let's just see what happens. They're going to go in and see what damage was done and repair it immediately. I mean, it might have perforated a bowel or a blood vessel of some kind. It's not the kind of situation where you can say, let's see, we might have a shot through the limb or something. That's not going to happen. And I think here, no question, he proximately caused the surgery scar. But for his action, it would not have been surgery. And I think that Brown and all those other proximate cause cases makes clear that's all we're talking about. Is did he start it in motion, and was there absent any kind of intervening? Was there improper surgery? You know, did the doctors do something wrong?
Well, even in the civil context, even if the doctor did something wrong, so long as the victim did not negligently choose the physician, which, given the ambulance and the unconscious victim in this case, couldn't have been the case, a tortfeasor is liable for negligent surgery because it's deemed to be a proximate cause.
Yes, sure. I mean, I think there was so few cases where, in the criminal area, you would find a proximate cause, proximate cause no longer effective because of an intervening event. And that's certainly not true here. There's not the slightest evidence that there was anything wrong. The defendant could have put on that evidence and say, well, I know, usually you would have to have an operation, but in this case it wasn't necessary because my expert will say that it was just probably a clean wound, no problem, didn't have to have the surgery. We don't have that, so what we have is an inference by the judge, which is fully reasonable, that this is exactly what the doctor should have done, and it should have been foreseen, and therefore he's responsible for the aggravated element of the offense.
Let me ask you, Mr. Murphy, in following up on what opposing counsel, Mr. Hargett, was arguing to us, let's assume for purpose of my question that the surgical scar cannot constitute the basis for the aggravated malicious wounding. Would this court have to reverse the aggravated malicious wounding conviction?
Yes, sure. There's nothing else but the scar. I mean, it's conceded that that is a qualifying injury, but the two scars from the bullet entering are trivial, minor, and apparently
healed as best we can tell. After the other scar is so great, you really can't tell whether there's any scar from the bullets left or not, right?
That's right. And, you know, there's no question...
A bullet.
It was admitted by counsel then and here that it's a permanent scar, so it's qualifying. It's the only qualifying injury. There's no physical impairment sufficient to satisfy. So the only
other
question,
than the pain, but that's only intermittent,
yes, sure,
and not debilitating.
Yes, sure. Thank you.
Mr. Hargett, you have your 3 minutes. We asked some more questions, so I'll give you the full 3 minutes that you requested.
Thank you, Your Honor. Appreciate that. I just have really 2 points here, and that is getting back to the crux of the case. The way the statute is written, if the victim is thereby severely injured and is caused to suffer permanent and significant physical impairment, I think that there is some ambiguity there about whether that requires that the defendant be the one who caused those things, not somebody else causing those things. This is a very unique statute. This is a very unique situation. I would dare say that any time, this is basically attributable to, if you will, a flesh wound. There's no other evidence that suggests that it's anything other than that. Of course, it does travel a long way, so it's a bit disconcerting in that regard. But when you talk about directly causing the injury,
does the word direct appear in the statute?
It does not. But I would argue that there is some ambiguity there about that, whether the legislative intent was that it be caused by the defendant himself. Keep in mind, this is not a situation where we're talking about anything other than the resulting injury as that element of the offense, the thing that makes it aggravated. And so they certainly could have phrased it differently, but we don't need to get into that. All we need to say is if there is any ambiguity, it needs to be resolved in the favor of the defendant. The second thing that I would say is that if you look over on appendix page 31, where the discussion occurs regarding, and it's multiple pages, I was pointing to 31. There's a lot of discussion here. The prosecution argues that you have to assume if somebody is shot, they're going to need surgery. They don't say that's a reasonable inference. That's the top of page 31 of the appendix. The judge says, right, and it's going to leave a scar. And so they're talking about the surgery. And he goes, well, I don't know. If it goes through and through, I don't have any doctor to say here it was one shot or two shots or through and through. And then the judge said, and the prosecutor agrees. He says, I don't know whether they opened him up, did exploratory surgery, or closed it up and said it didn't hit anything significant. And here's the problem. The judge is admitting that he doesn't know what the reason for the surgery was other than the fact that somebody was shot. And I understand that, it does seem like.
Refresh my memory, was the bullet still in him or did it exit him?
Through and through.
Okay, that's what I thought.
Yeah, that was the.
So you have the two places where there could have been scars, but we really don't know now because of the surgery.
I wouldn't say we don't know, Your Honor. I mean, I cited those pages. We did a very short statement of facts.
They totally healed. So there's no scar at all from the bullet wounds, entry or exit.
I phrased it this way. The spots for the entry and exit wounds were small and could clear up. That was certainly the testimony. He was eventually taken to the hospital and had surgery. And then I talk about the length of the scar.
And eventually was right away. It wasn't like a week later. It was he went from the scene by emergency transport directly to the hospital, directly to surgery. That was the evidence.
The person who testified about that said it very quickly. I don't know that you can certainly make those inferences if you wish, but he says, I had to have surgery because of this. I don't think that he actually said it was that day that he had surgery. I can't recall exactly, but that is not the focus of this case, really. Whether he had surgery that day or the next day doesn't really matter for my argument, is what I'm saying.
Mr. Hargett, you have gone over now. Do you want to just wrap up quickly?
That's it, Your Honor, and I would just ask that the court reverse. Just the aggravated malicious wounding, I think that in that case the remedy would be to find him guilty of malicious wounding only and remand for sentencing on that portion of the case. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hargett. We will greet counsel, and then the court will take a brief recess.